Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 202 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. What a time we're having at the moment, right? Last week's episode was 201, obviously. That's how numbers work. And it was the long-awaited chat with Cedric Bixler about the drive-in and the Mars Volta and numerous other projects. And thankfully, it seemed to live up to all your expectations, guys, because it's one that I've been promising for a long time. I'm a big fan of Cedric. I wanted to do the interview that I've always wanted to hear with him. And although we only had an hour, it was quite tight. It went down a treat, it felt. And the week before that, obviously, was the big 200th episode with Jess Tom, Tourette's hero. What a reaction I've got to that. 2 weeks on and I'm still getting messages about that episode and the impact. So, go and check that out. That had to be the 200th one because I knew it was going to be one of the best I've ever done. This week's guest is Beans on Toast. I love Beans on Toast, the person and the food. The person more, in fact. I don't eat the food very often, but I enjoy any opportunity to say hello to Jay. I've known Beans on Toast for years. We get into all of this. I don't know why I'm telling you. What I will tell you is this is a double episode. I'll mention that last week's episode with Cedric got some love from the 2000 Trees Festival, which gets some love in this podcast. And it was recorded before that happened, so that's nice. And 2000 Trees has got At the Drive-In and Enter Shikari, obviously previous guest on the podcast as well. So their lineup this year is strong. And Beans on Toast has played there numerous times. That's why it comes up in this conversation. But I'll tell you that I'm doing double episodes again this week because I've got some great ones. I've put these two together, so it'll be the Wednesday today and Friday, because they're both just such amazing insights into the music industry. So you'll hear Beans on Toast now, but next week I've got Nick Hawkes, who started XL, who signed The Prodigy, who brought Adam F over to EMI and got him in working with hip-hop legends. He signed House of Pain. He did all sorts of stuff, and his stories are absolutely amazing. He's just started a podcast with Eddie Temple Morris, absolute legend of the Distraction Pieces podcast. One of the best episodes we've ever done, way, way back. He's just started a podcast with Eddie called Trailblazers, and it's talking to kind of legends of the dance scene. So I think the first week is Gary Newman, and then Fatboy Slim and Goldie and all sorts of great people. So, yeah, some really good music industry ones, and I thought I'd double them up because I'm just recording so many at the moment. But speaking of the music industry, one of the things that comes up a lot in both of these conversations is the changes in the way the music industry works. And in fact, when Beans on Toast was last week on the Hardcore Listening podcast, he talked about his adapting of different ways to try and keep money in the bank and tick over now that people kind of steal music or everything becomes free. And one of them raised ways to support me and other artists on Speech Development Records is to go to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and buy some of our lovely merch. There's loads of good stuff there. I know I say it every week. If you've heard it more than 10 times and never bought anything, it might be time to chip in. You know, you've had, that's at least 10 hours of free entertainment. That's worth a t-shirt, right? They're beautiful t-shirts as well. So yeah, that's what's going on there. speechdevelopmentrecords.com for all your needs. I'm going to get into the podcast and I'll be back at the end with more information of what's to come of upcoming podcasts and all sorts of stuff. So this is episode 202 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Beans on Toast. And we're rolling. I'm joined today by Beans on Toast. I always call you Beans on Toast rather than, like, I know your name's Jay. I know people call you Jay. I've got a weird thing about, like, I call DJ a Yoda. I won't call him Duncan. Weirdly, it's a weird sentence. I know a lot of wrestlers now.
Okay.
I'll never call any of them by their actual names. I like if someone's chosen a name.
Exactly. If you give yourself a silly name, you know, you should be called by it.
Exactly. And why is a name that some people who hadn't met you yet gave you more important than the name you chose yourself when you kind of, you've got to know yourself a bit?
And I've, it's a weird thing with journalists, I find.
Yeah.
Where people are like, when I started off, I didn't put my name out there at all. And people were like, we need to know your real name.
Yeah.
It needs to be
mad, isn't it?
Jay McAllister, also known as Beans and Toast. And it's like, but surely if I've just, for all intents and purposes, you know, here I am Beans and Toast.
Exactly the same. And it's like, I swear it's a word count thing sometimes. I've had that numerous times.
I don't know your real name, so you've done a good job.
Yeah,
don't give it away.
They'll put it in there. They'll put it in articles all the time, and it'll be like, what's that adding to the article? Do you know what I mean? Like, surely you can real name, like, I'm not going to say that, only because you don't know.
Don't spoil the magic. It's easy to find out. Don't spoil the magic.
But just, what's that adding to a description or article, that your birth name? It's like adding height or anything else. It's like, you don't need these extra
descriptors. Yeah, agreed. And I'll happily answer to, you know, Beans on Toast or Jay or anything. I've had all sorts over the years. Mr. Mashed Potato was probably the best one.
Has it ever been, or has it often been a problem that people think that Beans on Toast is a band rather than a person? The reason I say this is I was saying to my dad, I was having you on, and he saw you at Wembley, and
right,
we'll get onto that.
Yeah.
And I love my dad dearly, but like everyone's parents, his memory comes and goes a little bit. It's hazy, and he was like, oh, yeah, I remember them. They were a good band. Are they still together? And I didn't even bother correcting him. I was like, yeah.
It's certainly never been a problem. And, you know, for over the years, Beans on Toast has been a band or a duo. And it does kind of forever change. And I like to think that when people kind of book in Beans on Toast or come in to see Beans on Toast, they're sort of like happy that they might get a mix of different bits. I'll always be there. We haven't done any Beans on Toast gigs without me yet. But yeah, it can be a band. It can be a moniker for a solo thing. It just rolls like
that. It's good. And it's nice because it, you're the central point of that. I remember there was a point when I was touring and I was really starting to panic over, all right, well, are they expecting a spoken word gig or are they expecting a live band gig
or a Dan the Sack
gig and all that? And then you realise that if you're doing any or all of them well, it shouldn't matter too much.
Hopefully
you get them there. You don't want to.
The variety's got to be nice as well, really. I think and being able to do different, you know, perform on different levels and at different. Because the Wembley show, you know, we was a duo. So your dad wasn't necessarily too far off the mark when he said, are they still about?
And performing at different levels is one of the key things there, and it's one of the things I've always been a huge fan of with you, is you have always seen as at home in a pub as you are in a venue, as you are in literally a stadium.
That's
hard to do at times, you know. Billy Bragg, obvious example of just being able to turn up with him and a guitar and play absolutely anywhere, but you always, not even necessarily sound wise but kind of attitude and delivery and performance wise, always remind me of Billy Childish as well, who was one who just always was. I'd see him at the Forum and then I'd be at a random pub the next night and he'd be in there just playing and not minding, you know.
Yeah, I treat every gig exactly the same. I've been lucky to play some incredible sort of show. It's easy to judge a gig on how many people are there and oh, there's loads of people there, therefore it sort of should be thought about differently. I enjoy them all, you know, and I still, on my travels, you know, I still play the odd gig when there's no one there, and there's a little bit to start for us, like, oh man, you know, what am I doing? But then a couple of songs in, I'm loving it.
Yeah.
I still enjoy it, you know, and I guess that, you know, that's what kind of ties it all together is me enjoying the show.
And that's the thing. I remember I've had gigs. I did a gig in a nightclub at 2 a.m. and it was a proper drinks offers nightclub. Like,
right.
One room was a karaoke room. Another room was all just like dance bangers. And then me and Dan in this random in a ski lodge in the Alpine lodge room. And there was, I think, six people there to see us. But that sticks in my head as one of my favourite gigs because it suddenly occurred to me, I was like, right, I don't like it here. And these six people have stayed till 1, 2 a.m.
Right, okay.
In this not that welcoming place for alternative types to watch us. So, it's like,
we have to
put on a hell of a show.
Yeah, you've got to go all out.
It's weird because Wembley was an example. And again, we'll go into it more, but both of us played a supporting Frank Turner. And it was one where I was hugely excited about it. And then while it was happening, I wasn't having as much fun as at some gigs. Just because of the distance between the stage and the audience and the weirdness of it. I enjoyed it in hindsight, but I remember at the time just thinking, just smash all the songs, do the best performance you can, and it'll be over.
Right.
Which is a weird one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I had an incredible time. You know, I crowd surfed off the stage while the DJ played, what was it? Mr. Big Stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It was, I mean, your performance at Wembley was a favourite of... was a highlight of mine. Obviously, Frank was amazing. Watching
the
Billy
whole night was so incredible. It was like such a big move for Frank at the time, and
but
everybody else on the bill was Essex as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It was
Frank and the Essex Boys.
Frank headlining with you, me, and Dan Lesac and Billy Bragg, and you. And the cool thing was that the crowd was there from the start. So when you went out, it was rammed. And the thing that slayed me was, again, are you treating it like any other gig? And you started a song and people started to clap and you stopped and said, oh, sorry, that ruins it a bit if you do that.
There's no nice way of saying that.
I know how this song goes, just leave it to me. And
I've been trying to say that for years.
Because people's dream of playing Wembley, having them all clapping along and you're like, it's actually going to ruin it a little bit. So if you can just not do that, just listen.
Yeah, there's no nice way to say that. But I've been trying for years. It's like people get into it. Just because my timing's bad.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's like if I have to keep in time with the crowd, it's always
the crowd are always going to, particularly in Wembley, there's going to be a variation
a bit of
in timing. Because it's bouncing around and you're at one point.
Yeah, that show, after that show, I was actually, because it did go so well. And it was, you know, I had a 20-minute slot. Like I said, I smashed it out, wrote the song for it. And then just because I just didn't want to get off stage, that was like, you got, because the whole thing was, you know, you don't overrun when you're on first at a gig like that. But I was just like too excited. So I just jumped into the crowd and kind of crowd surfed off.
Yeah.
And that was that. But then after that, Frank kind of deemed me sort of arena ready. And the next, so like maybe a year or maybe 2 years later, when he did his full kind of first arena, sort of like O2, MEN, I did that as well.
Amazing.
And by the end of that, I mean, it was just like, for me, things get easier. You know, I think it's harder to play to no one than it is to 20,000. 20,000, it's like the game's already, you must be doing something to even be there.
And you and Frank are quite interlocked and his fan base know you. Although you were on first, I would
people
guarantee
show up. Yeah.
More people knew you than me and Dan who were on after you. And you know,
because of the links over the years. Yeah, of course.
And that's a great thing because it meant that that warmth and reception of the opening act again was there from the start. And that can be a tough thing when people get to the size of doing arenas, they've had their hardcore fans and they've brought in a load of extra fans who aren't really that into gigs, aren't really that into seeing.
A lot of people,
but that's not the case.
We're like, you know, first on at arenas isn't, they might have been on the tour. First night was in Cardiff Motorpoint Arena. And I was with a mate who was like, look, just heads up. Like, don't get too bummed out if there's not, you know, if there, 'cause 1,000 people are empty. And I was like, one, shut up. You know, I'm playing at Cardiff Motorpoint. Don't tell me to not go. I was like, too. It's like, it's Frank Turner. I was like, the place will be rammed.
And
when I
got
to the place rammed, it was. And
that,
you know,
that was
Wembley and the rest of the tour afterwards, all like that.
It's amazing. He's built that fan base. And again, it's something.
The new record's incredible as well.
I haven't heard it
yet. Privy to a few listens.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Well, when I had him on the podcast, one of the things we talked was basically that we both kind of built this fan base that, because when we tour, we pick supports that number one, we think are going to blow the crowd away. And number two, it's a selfish thing. I'm hearing that support every night.
Right,
I want them to be really good. So,
and it coming with a
really
stamp
good.
Of approval,
yeah,
you know, if it,
exactly.
by sort of putting your neck out and saying, we chose this person to come because of these reasons, then, and like a stamp of approval goes a long way. And I think, you know, for people that are buying tickets, you know, the band that is selling the tickets should, you know, should encourage the you know, a good evening's worth of entertainment and for everybody's money, you know.
That's it. And it's the money thing now. It always blows my mind when people, because we'd get, again, as similar to Frank, get a lot of love from the fact that our crowd would get there early as they can and the bulk of them would watch everything. And my mind is always, again, it might be a working class Essex thing, but it's like, well, you've paid, didn't you?
Yeah.
So you may as well get your money's
night,
worth.
Get in there as well. Yeah, yeah. Get in extras, there, watch
get
it.
Drinks,
yeah.
Have a good night and take it all in. So what was your route into music? When did you start off? Because when I joined the scene, it felt as if you'd kind of always been around. And it was a beautiful time. I don't know if it's because the music that I made and me and Dan made didn't really fit into any one genre, but it meant that we kind of got to mix with tons of genres.
Course,
we,
yeah.
We weren't in the rap, in the UK rap scene, but we had a lot of mates there, and we could meet a lot of
same with the indie and whatnot.
Yeah,
suppose, which was
in there with the indie kids, and you do a lot of gigs with the spoken word crowds and with that kind of thing, and that's kind of, it felt like there was this constant beautiful crossover of just people with a similar outlook rather than a similar sound.
Definitely.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and just making good music at the time, I think. Like, I was, you know, as far as getting into music, you know, I sort of pretended I was in a band before I could play an instrument, basically. Yeah. Like, we just used to graffiti the band's name around school and just tell everyone, like, we're in a band.
Amazing.
And then it was like, that came first. And then it was like, shit, we got to, you know, we should probably get some instruments at least.
I still don't think I've told anyone. This might be the first time I've said this out loud, but my first band, Antipenultimate, was completely fiction. It was purely me making cool designs and telling my mates at school I was in a band because I was like, oh, this is my band.
Right, that's it, yes.
So that's, even in my head, I started to trick myself. When someone was asking the other day, what was your first band? I was like, well, there was Antipenultimate, and then there was Lardass. It's like, Lardass only ever met up for two or three practices, but we booked gigs that we never turned up to, so that we'll be listed in the local papers. We did all of that kind of build that hype.
It did turn into, we was called Jellicar Band, and it did turn into a, you know, there was three of us,
a
and after
thing.
Graffiti in the band, we was like, right, okay, who's going to play what?
We've committed to it.
Yeah, and you know, we just sort of, we learned how to play kind of free chord grunge songs to get, you know, we learn our instruments together.
Yeah.
And just as that kind of faded, I was sort of songwriting for that band, and I just loved songwriting basically.
Yeah.
From that first song that I wrote, I there hasn't been a kind of couple of weeks past where I haven't written a song. It's
amazing.
Just like, just creating. So I just enjoy the process of creating something out of nothing. And it's just, I don't know whether it, I don't know what would have happened to me if I stopped, basically.
Yeah.
So I've never tried. So just always been writing, and slope from that. I was never really listening to, like, you know, I grew up on a lot of country music, but I never set out to make folk music or anything.
Yeah.
It was just like, I was writing songs on an acoustic guitar with the idea of putting a band together.
Yeah.
And I was going to call the band Beans on Toast. And by this time, you know, I'd moved to London by this time and was running and working in pubs and clubs, basically.
Yeah.
So that was why I was a lot hooked up with. I used to manage a band called The Holloways, run a club night called Frog in central London, which was like, you know, 1,000-cap club every Saturday.
Amazing.
With everybody like passing through. So kind of doing that predominantly. And at the same time, just kind of filling in the gaps with my own tunes.
Yeah.
And then at Glastonbury one year, I had these like 10 songs. And at Glastonbury, there was just a guitar and a kind of open mic type stage. And I got up and I just try out these songs. And I reckon by the time I'd done the second song, I was like, shit, I don't need a band.
Yeah.
It was preaching to the converted. This was singing songs about getting hammered at festivals to hammered people at festivals.
Yeah,
and it went down a tree.
Know your crowd.
Yeah, it went down a tree. And it was like, oh, man. And just from that first Glastonbury gig, again, I've never really sort of pushed shows on anybody. I did that gig. And I got offered another one.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was living in a pub in Holloway Road and putting on gigs there, so I could book my own. I'd put myself on a support.
What pub was that?
Nambuka.
Nambuka.
There was
one kind of Camden way, I seem to remember.
After
after
Nambuka burnt down, then we kind of, like off the out of the ashes, the crew went to a few. We did Flowerpot in Kentish Town.
Yeah.
And then
Flowerpot was one that I kind of always knew if I was up that way, if I popped in, I could probably catch a Beans on Toast gig. And it was numerous times. I'd just be like, let's pop by. And you'd be playing and doing a little acoustic set. It was like, you don't even need listings. It was just percentages are decent.
Yeah, yeah. That was actually me. I was supposed to be booking the bands and it just went on full short. I'd just have sort of like
just take it up.
Which worked, you know. And from that, it just like one gig would lead to another.
Yeah.
And without kind of ever having a sort of plan or sort of setting out to sort of achieve anything. I was just, you know, had loads of gigs and loads of songs and then just recorded them and put the first album out.
I love it because it makes sense hearing it that way, that in many, like most people start on the local scene and then after a few years build their way up to festivals, and it feels like you kind of started more at festivals, and you've always had that vibe. But like, I think you've always been a really popular festival act because exactly that, you're preaching to the converted, you're giving them.
Yeah,
you're one of them. I went to these festivals.
Yeah. You know, like, I mean, I was going to, you know, talk about the book, which is very sort of like festival heavy, but you know, I went to, before I started playing at any festivals, like I religiously went to them.
Yeah,
you know, and people were like, "How'd you get gigs at festivals?" I was like, "Just go. It's a good start." You know, like, and if you got a guitar or whatever, take that with you. You know,
you and Kate Tempest were two that I always associated with. You'd just be at festivals, you'd, whether you're booked or not. But also, if you're booked for one gig, I know I'm going to have a lot of opportunities to see you because you'll be about. Kate's my hero.
Hey, I first saw her at playing in a tiny little tent in the sort of unfair ground at Glasto years and years ago. Yeah. And that right there and then I was like, she's probably got the power to change the world.
Yeah.
And then seeing her at West Holt's, you know, crying my eyes out like last year. She's incredible. So
it's ridiculous, isn't it? And it's those people who've got an urgency to just get up there and do it. And I think that's what makes it, rather than ask, how do I get a gig here? How do I do this? And do that?
Not
taking the time to ask, just going, let's go and figure it out.
Mm.
Let's go down there and we'll see. And we'll see who we meet and see what we...
Yeah, and like, so rather than asking, stuff being offered is always nice, you know, because that would be the thing. You do one show and someone will go, oh, you know, I think if people know that you're up for it as well, then it's like, oh, I've got this bar, or I've got this, you know, tent at this festival. But, you know, before I knew it was like, my summers were round.
It's key, man. One of the bits, as I was saying before we got started, I've been in London today as well, and I've had to wear a suit because it was for an audition, but now I'm home, I'm in my comfy trousers and my hoodies so we can relax and just chat. But one of the things, the best bits of advice I got for auditions was, you know, the person who's auditioning you, it's their job to cast someone in that role. So they want you to get that,
of course.
And it's a similar thing on that, on gigs. It's like, you know, there's someone who needs to book bands. They need bands, they need to fill spaces. So it's not this kind of, oh, how can I convince them? It's like, if you can present yourself and do a decent job, then they're going to be all over you. They're going to be
100%. That's, they need, you know, they need music as much as you need gigs, you know.
It's their job too, to fill these slots, to fill these hours in numerous places. So, and again,
and I guess that goes across the board for the whole of the industry as well, isn't it? You know, it's like,
it's knowing that
it feels like someone sort of made you feel like, you know, for an artist, you're the one that, you know, hasn't got anything to offer, and all this, everyone else around you has to sort of like give you leg ups or whatnot. When really, you know, it's like, and you know, I suppose when, you know, the sort of instant stars of the world, you know, when sort of like the first time Florence and the Machine you know, it's like she sings, everyone's like, she's in, you know, we'll work the business around you. So, you know, I guess there is a bit of that.
I always remember doing gigs early on with Florence and with Paloma Faith, and both of them just being, well, they have to get huge.
Yeah,
this can't work in a little pub forever. Once or twice, it's a nice novelty, but this is too big.
This is a worldwide superstar right here down the local pub.
Huge,
and it's good when they do turn into the, and it's like, oh, you know, phew. I've made some pretty bad calls. I remember seeing like Coldplay in the new band's tent at some festival and being like, yeah, it's not really going to go. It's just like ripping off Radio.
They're not going to work.
And then like three years later, watching them headline Pyramid Stage and being like singing along, everyone. Every word.
What's your feeling on bands like Coldplay or that experience? And Frank will be someone who's had it of the backlash when you do break through. Because I'm not particularly a Coldplay fan, but can they write some good songs?
Definitely.
They can write amazing songs. It annoys me when people are like, "Oh, they're shit." No, they're amazing. Yeah, it's not always to my taste.
Yeah, but I've not got a bad word to say about bands that do well. There's bands that you kind of love to hate out there, but I keep that, I'm not going to say that on a podcast. I keep that between me and my friends. But yeah, I think that a lot of it's really justified. You know, like Ed Sheeran, for example, I think he gets a lot of shit. And, considering he's a sort of like, he's not like the best looking chap. He writes his own songs and he doesn't come from the sort of like a particularly easy background. And it's like, if that's a great guy to have as a pop star, 100%. out of all the choices. And it's like, and he does things like play stadium solo. It's like, good on him.
I remember hearing that Ed was a bit bummed out. And again, because people are humans. And it was, I think, Enemy or someone had just put him as most hated person in music or something like that, and I'm messaging him in that morning saying, "I've just woken up and I've gone on Google or whatever, and the first news is a photo of you playing guitar. Behind you is Stevie Wonder on piano, in front of you is Jay-Z rapping, and next to you, leaning up against your back, is Beyonce." It's like, you don't really have to worry what fucking Enemy think about you or what some hipsters think. And then, and again, Ed's another one. He kind of knows his music isn't always to my taste. I think he's got some bangers, but some of it isn't.
I didn't realize you were friends.
It's amazing. But it's fucking. Yeah. I get stick for this all the time because I talk about Adele and Ed Sheeran and all these, and it's all people that I've knocked about with in the past. It's not like we're on the phone all the time now, so I can't overclaim that. But again, it's one of them. The first time I met Ed, he reminded me of you. Because he was someone that was just up for going anywhere and everywhere to do a gig.
Right.
5 minutes or a 10-minute slot in Liverpool.
Do it.
Well, am I going to break even or whatever? I'll do it. I'll come up there. I'll do
it.
And
that was kind of that, now, isn't
that atmosphere. Yeah, exactly. He's breaking in. But again, he's doing, as you said, you see some of the pop stuff that gets a backlash. He did like 4 nights or something at Wembley or 10 nights at Wembley with him and a guitar.
Solo, yeah.
It's and like, that's it.
What do you want from your pop stars if it's not that?
Yeah, you don't have to like it, but I demand you respect it. I demand it. So what's been the key, do you think, for the longevity of your career? Because you've been doing this a while and it's not like you've got to that point of Ed Sheeran where all your bills are paid. So
I think ultimately sticking to my guns, and I think that it's weird music as doing it as a kind of job or a career or whatever. It's seen that it's supposed to always kind of get bigger and get better. Every tour is supposed to be bigger than the last. Whereas that's never really, I'm quite happy playing 200 cap rooms around the country. Yeah. And if I can fill them, then financially it pays better than any other job I've ever had. And it's like, I think cultivating a kind of plateau is, not that I'd say no to a bigger show, of course not. Yeah. But it's like, I think I've never really, like I said from the start, I didn't have any plan. And it's just been, I'm still doing, I've been doing it for a long time, but I'm still doing the same thing, and that's either brilliant or tragic, and I just try not to ponder too much on which one it is.
I completely agree. I think the industry is a tough one because as soon as you start to have success in it, there's a pressure to compare yourself again, either to previous tours or previous albums or whatever else, or to other people in the industry you should be climbing.
I don't really get involved with the industry. I've got a small team of people that I work with, Extra Mile put the records out, Adam books my shows, and they're friends first and foremost. And it's quite easy. I do most all the sort of management role or any sort of design stuff. I'd make all the decisions myself. So there's not that sort of cuts out a lot of time, whatnot. And from doing this, from releasing an album every year, it's kind of like I can plan quite far ahead. It's like, and it's almost like just doing the same thing. So it's quite easy, actually.
But it's treating it as if it's again, it's that awareness that if I wasn't doing this, I'd have to be in whatever other job I've got at 9 a.m. till 5 a.m. I mean, so I'm going
to
do this.
So far in now, it's like, yeah. I don't know how I'd get, I don't know, you know, not that I'd want to, but it's, you know, I don't know what I would do. You know, this is it now, you know, this is what I do for my life. And like, you know, and folk music, I think, you know, like, you don't have to be young, so I can,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I could be an old man singing songs about the old days or
I've
whatever.
Numerous songs. It's why I'm transitioning into acting, because as a rapper, I don't know if you want to be a 50-year-old rapper. I don't know if it's the way to go. Some, you know, the icons can pull it off, but for me, it doesn't appeal too much. But and folk music's an interesting one because it's a broad,
you know, spectrum, isn't it?
It's a very broad spectrum. You know? I put an album out by a guy called Giacomo Brown on my label, which I'll give you a copy of.
Please do, yeah.
Because I think you'll like. And it was a weird one because I was like, well, it's folk. But at the time we were putting it out, Mumford & Sons had just become the biggest band in the world. Sure. And I was like, it's nothing like Mumford & Sons.
Right.
It's kind of
that,
more, got
folk.
More blues in it than folk, but it's folk. And the appeal of that was a similar thing to you there. Giacomo Brown had no interest in touring. He'd done two gigs and didn't see the appeal.
Right, okay.
He had no interest in being a career musician. He just had these songs. He happily works in the library. It's fine doing that.
Right,
I had to twist his arm to put it out. But it meant that as a label, having seen a bit of the inside of the industry, I was like, this album would not exist if I don't put it out. Because if they're not up for touring it, they're not up for doing this and that.
Okay.
And in the end, we put it out and it got 8 out of 10 in Uncut. It got good reviews and things like that. It's a good record, but people ask me all the time, so when's his next album? It's like, no, that was it.
Right.
He had a record he wrote.
Oh, that's kind of beautiful,
I had to twist his arm to put it out. There's no desire and appeal there. But again, it's kind of, it feels similar as well in that all of your ventures, although there's albums every year, it's weird when I see you announce a tour because it's like, well, you're never kind of off
it
the road. Really. It's like,
you still have to promote them.
Oh, these are all on one poster, are they? Okay, so that's cool. That kind of comes together. But it's that thing. It's never been that, right, we're aiming for this chart position or this or that. It's like, no, this is what...
Yeah, if I'm not gigging, I don't know what I do kind of scenario. So keep gigging and keep, you know... And keep writing and recording and releasing music. I'll do it, you know. I do it because I love it. You know, I was doing it for a long time before I saw any cash from it for fun, you know. And now it's turned into, you know, it is what I do. So, and, you know, and little add-on bits where it does, you know, actually you free up quite a lot of time. And I think it's quite important to keep it fresh. So, yeah, over the years, I've made documentaries about small towns across England.
Yeah.
And, stuff like that, and now,
and that's
I've got
what's interesting.
Book.
You got the book as well,
yeah,
and that
exactly.
is it's the keeping it interesting, and it is a world now where beautifully we can kind of do multiple things. If you're someone who's on the road constantly, then you've got a lot of time on the road there, so you can do little documentaries about small towns.
Yeah,
and little,
exactly.
And the book is top drunk stories.
Drunk Folk Stories, it's called. Yeah, and it was written predominantly in last year in Germany. I was traveling solo on the trains, so I'd spend like 4 or 5 hours a day on a train, and I was just like, I need a project. You know, I can't just sit and watch bloody films all day.
Yeah.
Started writing what turned into an actual book, which is something I never ever thought I'd do. You know, I'm not particularly good at sort of spelling or grammar, but
it's mad,
I had sort of the books arrive tomorrow at my house.
Amazing.
And it's you know, it's really exciting. It's I mean, you know, I've always, as well as being a songwriter, I guess a storyteller.
That's
on
what I was
stage.
Gonna say. You've got the storytelling in the songs and in between the songs. It's always been, I will get as much enjoyment hearing you talk in between the songs. It helps that you've got the DMX of folk voice. So I'll have as much fun of hearing you tell the story about this song as them playing the song.
And people would often say you should write, you know, you should jot them down and they are stage stories that are about, you know, introductions to songs that once I started writing them down, it was like, oh, right, I'd talk a bit more about where I was at that part of my life. And it's like, and it all sort of like swung together. So it's 10 short, true stories And yeah, it's out in May, sort of self-publishing it. And I sort of got my head around all that, which there's incredible companies out there that help you.
Yeah.
And, yeah, like I said, it arrives tomorrow.
Amazing.
And then so doing a tour of...
And how's the tour going to work? Because are you just going to be doing the stories, or are you going to be doing...
No, not at all. All in all, it's like there's a lot going on, basically. It's like, so the book was out, and then it's also... So this year will be my 10th album.
Yeah.
And I've been doing an album a year. So in my head, I thought that meant my first album had been out 10 years this year.
Right.
So actually, it's 9, because you start on 0.
Right, of course.
But maths has never been my strong point. Yeah, exactly.
That's interesting, because this year it's the 10th anniversary of Angles, which was my first album.
Right.
And again, in my memory... You were knocking about at the same time, like before us and all that kind of thing. So it's kind of weird. It's like, how's your album not 9 yet? And as is, I hope we've calculated it right. I think we have.
Yeah, I double check because I organised the whole thing. I was like, well, look, the first album was called Standing on a Chair. I was quite interested in doing a seated tour.
Yeah.
So I'm doing a tour called Sitting on a Chair and I was like, I'll re-release the album on vinyl. It never came out on vinyl.
Amazing.
So I'll release the first album on vinyl, do a seated tour, released the book, and then I was like, that album came out in 2009, it's fucking 9 years. But the button had already been pressed.
Yeah.
So it was like, okay, so celebrate its seminal 9-year anniversary, standing on a chair.
Yeah, yeah.
And just sort of, you know, we're just rolling with it. So the album's coming out on vinyl, which you're all sitting in my living room as well as we speak.
How's that? Because the weird thing about your first album is you make your first album and you've no idea that this is going to be a career. This is going to be something that people
hear. It's it was 50 tracks recorded in 4 days, album as well. So it's quite scatty. And
how many of them have you got any idea of now? Like, if you had to play that album, how tough would that? How long would you have to practice to remember it?
Give me a guitar and go now, I reckon I could probably do about maybe 10 of the 50. But give me a half hour and I'll rehearse them all. You know, they're still the same chords.
It's just remembering
the words. So the tour's going to be a little bit like, you know, a sort of looking back at that record and all the records since, but in a seated capacity.
And have you ever done kind of...
I've done a few, you know, I've played so many weird gigs over the years. Every now and then a one pops up where the crowd has sat down. And if the crowd has sat down, I'll pull up a chair and sit down as well.
Yeah.
It's generally the rule. And so that's the kind of idea of this tour.
Yeah.
And I've never done a full tour for it, and it will still be, I'll definitely still have my guitar, and it will be, and I'm not going to like read stories out of the book. I mean, any of the stories I could recount off the top of my head anyway, but you know, ultimately I think maybe I'll do like one story from the book a night, other bits and bobs. And normally I try and stop myself from talking during my gigs, which I know I talk a lot, but I'm like, you know, I'm chatty tonight, like,
that's
and
right,
just try.
Yeah.
But this for the seated one, yeah, I've got a nice long set, and I'll just be like, rather than holding back on the stories, I'll kind of tell it, you know,
allow
I'll happily chat
flow.
And then do a tune. And I'm also going to kind of like, if anybody, because I've got so many songs, people like shout out random ones at gigs, and I never know it. So people can mail in beforehand, like
Perfect.
2 days before, so
makes tons
you
of
never
sense.
Play this song. So I can kind of give me a day to learn it and sort of, and just a bit of a...
That's the weird bit that people don't understand. And I guess it's what I was kind of thinking on the debut album is there's people who listen to certain songs religiously, but if it's not a song that's made it into your regular touring over, then you're not going to have thought of it potentially
people shout
five
out
years,
once and I look at it, I was like, I didn't even know that song existed, you know, like, have
What's
I even
that?
Got a song called that?
Are you just abusing me, or is that one of my songs? I'm going to do the boring part now of just saying that your tour is starting in May and going to Brighton, Bath, Derby, Kendal, Edinburgh, York, Sunderland, Belfast, Liverpool, Sheffield, Folkestone, Colchester and London.
Boom. That's not the boring part. That's the good bit.
Yeah, but you know, it's the bit that's impossible to try and remember, isn't it? So where are you going on the tour? Liverpool, I think. There's something in there. But that's exciting. I like the idea, again, that people can hit you up in advance and kind of say, I'd like to hear this.
Yeah. I guess if people would have done that in the past, I might, you know, I guess I have done, but I'll actually sort of purposely put a call out and say, look, if you want to, If you do want to tune, let me know, rather than on the spot, you know, give me, you know, and I'll just sort of rework it out.
Yeah. I love it. So, you've teased to me that there's a story in the book that's about or happened at a Lissette versus Pipkin.
Well, no, not
in some way or involved.
Yeah.
Or
so at the end of the book, there's a kind of disclaimer that says, as far as I'm aware, this happened. You know, like, and these, you know, over the years of telling stories, because I've been telling stories on stage, down the pub, you know, wherever, you know.
They get better and better.
They kind of, yeah, some, and generally for the sake of the story rather than the facts. Yeah, you know, like, yeah. That's how a story was shaped.
I'm a big fan of that.
At one part of this, I'll tell the story, and when I get to the point, you can tell me whether that bit actually happened or not, perfect. Basically. It's basically based around Reading Festival. Yeah. Which is, I went to Reading, like I said, like religiously. I first went to Reading when I was 16 years old, which would have been, 97? And I went every year.
I think 98 was the first year I went. Always had a dream of getting a canal boat for the festival. Right. Like renting out a canal boat, because it's like, how amazing would that be? It's in my little happy stone of mine. It's like, imagine just leaving the festival each night and you've got your canal boat.
It would be ace, yeah.
I'll do that.
Originally, you know, that was always the hardest festival to break into, Reading, because you had to get in every day, you know. You get into the campsite and then roof. But I went,
Glastonbury was easy at that point to break into.
Where I learned. I cut my teeth at Glastonbury and then I went to Reading, man. And was like, hang on a minute, like, how do you get in it?
I remember breaking into Glastonbury a few years in a row, and then one year I went with these other people, and it's a long drive to Glastonbury, and we got there and they went, no, it looks as if we're not being able to break in, the fence is too big, let's go home. And I was like, what? So while they stood there, I broke in myself, then broke out again to prove that we can get in and out.
Right.
I was like, now I'll give you a leg up or whatever. But yeah, Reading was always, because you had to break in the
every
festival
day.
As well. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, that's it. It's kind
get
of,
into the campsite quite
the
easy, and then you'd get into the arena day in, day out. But I went for years before I started playing. And in fact, I got my first gig at Reading. Again, how do you get gigs at festivals? Yeah. I got my first gig. I was working doing the clubs, and Frog did a club night there. And I had a bit of a problem with graffiti at the time, and I used to just tag Beans on Toast everywhere.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to do Reading and I'm going to do it properly. And I did every bin on site, and in the car parks, in the campsites,
amazing.
Everywhere. And I did a few tent walls, which was probably a bit of an arsey move. a few people, like I was literally like rip-roared through the whole thing. And it shit hit the fan, basically. Yeah. I was getting chased down. Like, the security didn't know who they was looking for, but all this. And then the next year, I got a mail from the chap who was booking it, who was like, Jay, if you leave your marker, if we book you to play Reading, will you leave your marker pen at home?
Yeah.
And I was like, you got yourself a deal.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'll take it.
A deal. I played first year I played would have been 2007 on the alternative stage.
Yeah.
Good as gold. And then the last year I ever went, and the last year I played was 2008 at Reading. And that was, from going to Reading forever, I hated Leeds Festival, as every good Reading attendee would.
100%.
And I was like, you know, I don't want to play Leeds, I just want to play Reading. And I was like, that's not how it works, you know. You've got to play Leeds. So I was like, me and my mate, I was like, well, look, what we'll do, we'll just spend all weekend at Leeds. I think I was playing Saturday in Leeds and Sunday in Reading. But I was like, let's go down to Reading. We'd do Thursday, Friday in Reading. We'd just bomb it up to Leeds, do the show, and bomb it back. And that was like all good. And that was the plan. And then so on the Friday, Rage Against the Machine were playing.
Yes.
And I was, you know, before I get stuck into this, I love Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
You know, who doesn't? What they've done for the world is indescribable. And for me personally. However, they went on stage with like bright orange jumpsuits in like this kind of weird Guantanamo Bay kind of protest, which was just a little bit, it felt a little bit weird for an American band to be coming in. And I was just like, I thought the stunt was a bit naff.
Right.
They didn't say anything about it.
Yeah.
They just did it. And then they kind of kicked into this tune. And I just wasn't really feeling the show. So I left and went to see Dan Lissack and Scroobius Pip.
It was the first time that we were headlining a stage and we were put up against
clashing.
Rage
I was
against
like,
the
he wouldn't forget if he was clashing.
Yeah,
so that's true.
No, it's completely true.
Boom.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So that's. I'm so glad that could look so bad for my book as well. 100%. So I left Rage and went to see you guys, and it was incredible. First time I saw you play, and then I kind of cracked on, and I spent the night kind of slagging off Rage and their stupid political stunt. And then halfway through my kind of banger of a night at Reading, walking through the kind of clothes stalls, I saw a bright, luminous kind of Guantanamo Bay suit. And I was just like, I'll buy it. So I got it. And then journeyed up to Leeds. So I did an all-nighter. My poor mate picked me up in the transit. And like we drove up to Leeds, me hammered, drinking like sort of White Lightning the whole way up there.
Amazing.
We get to Leeds. The show is like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I basically realised that I'm playing at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the tiny little alternative stage. The night that evening, Rage are playing at the main stage. So I was like, right. And at this time, this was before my first album came out. I wasn't expecting anybody to come to the gig, and I was hammered, and I thought I'd be hilarious. Basically, turns out I was on just before Henry Rollins.
Right.
Which,
wow.
You know, yeah, incredible. And incredible enough for people to fill the tent, regardless of who's playing beforehand.
Yeah.
So I get there, shit-faced. The tent is rammed, absolutely rammed solid. Also, this was back in the day when I used to stand on things at gigs. It was like a thing.
Yeah,
I'd stand on chairs or bar stools. And it turns out that a woman that was working on the stage at Leeds had been to a gig and was like, I've got a great idea. And she put like a bass case in the center of the stage and put a mic stand on it. So it's huge, like it looked stupid, but it's perfect, basically.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, brilliant. And then I basically was like, put on my orange jumpsuit and put a bin liner over my head.
Yeah.
And I was just cutting the eye holes in it when someone was like, right, you ready? You're going to go on. So I was like, I'll probably be able to manage without eye holes. And I walked out onto the stage and tried to climb up. After an all-nighter without a bin liner over my head, tried to climb on top of this bass thing.
Yeah.
And it went badly. You know, I kind of got up there. I was sweating really badly. I stood there and I said, I am making a profound political statement to a tent full of people that are about to watch Henry Rollins.
Yeah.
Quite up for a profound political statement.
Of course they are.
And I looked like a complete dick, basically. You know, who is this guy? What's he wearing Guantanamo Bay outfit for? And then I was like, it took me ages to get the bin liner off. And I hadn't plugged my guitar in. I spent like, I had a 25-minute set. I spent 15 minutes of it dicking around, basically. And then I finally got in. I played 10 minutes worth of songs, and I just left it. And I told one friend. It was like, what were you doing? What the fuck was all that? And I was like, Rage, you're going to go on in Guantanamo Bay outfits later. And he was like, what? I was like, I saw it last night. I was like, everyone thinks I'm a fucking idiot right now, but I was like, later,
it's gonna pay off.
Yeah, it'll be amazing. And he was like, seriously? I was like, yeah, seriously. I was like, you wait. Jumped in the car and bombed it back to Reading. Finally fell asleep. Woke up just as we got to Reading. And the one person that I told, my mate Ollie, just as we pulled into Reading, he just sent me a text and he was like, Rage didn't do it.
No,
they had their set cut short.
That's unbelievable.
And that was it, you know. So and that was the last time I ever played Reading or Leeds. I was never invited back.
I love it. I've got a weird one with that gig, because you'll know. I mean, as you said, with stadium gigs, but with festival gigs as well, you play your slot and then you go, right? So that's the first time me and Dan had ever headlined a slot. So I had no idea. It didn't even cross my mind that encores would be an option.
Right.
So we played our set, and Dan always ends on a big 5-minute ending. And I was like, oh, I can probably catch the last Rage song or two. So I come off stage and ran straight over to watch the end of Rage. And Dan was then furious with me because he came off, whole tent chanting for more. For 5 minutes. He's like, where's Pip? Couldn't find me anywhere.
He's gone to watch Rage, who you have all decided chose not to watch.
Yeah, so we didn't get to do an encore on that. I then, at Leeds, I stuck around because I got a right telling off. Because it's like, there's a whole...
Was you clashing with him at Leeds as well then?
Yeah.
That is an epic
match. A hell of a clash. The next time we got to headline a festival, a stage at a festival, was Glastonbury. And we were on at the same time as Stevie Wonder.
Oh, God.
And we're sitting there. He started about 20 minutes before us. And we're sitting there and listening. We're thinking, it'll be all right. Because Glastonbury headline sets are like 2 hour, 3 hours long.
Right, yeah. People can move around a little bit.
And then it'll be album tracks, blah, blah, blah. And we'll listen, he plays hit, 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 Michael Jackson cover, hit, hit. And we're like, ah. But again, it was another one. The tent was round and it was lovely and amazing. But yeah.
You're even more thankful then.
Yeah, exactly.
I did a Victorious Festival a couple of years back, and that was a bit of me too. Yeah. I was last minute added on. It is a longer story that is also in the book, but I was clashing with Calvin Harris and Noel Gallagher.
Oh wow!
It's like the country's most favorite songwriter and the country's favorite DJ.
Yeah.
Great gig, anybody that shows up out of choice when you've got them options and have come to watch me. I was like,
yeah.
You know, thanks, guys.
This is now turning into, it seems as if I'm boasting of my career highlights, but the first full festival that we got to headline was 2000 Trees.
Okay.
And that's a massive one for Frank and for you and everyone.
It's, years,
it's always had such a good atmosphere. What is it about that festival that's got that? Because it feels like everyone that was at 2000 Trees was at Wembley for Frank. And, do you know what I mean? It feels it feels almost like it's Frank's. It's a Frank gig. It's a Frank festival.
I don't know what cultivated that. I've played a few times over the years and have always enjoyed it. It's a great fit. Yeah, it's definitely, it's kind of got its own community, I guess,
putting it, isn't it? Completely. So what's, how do you find touring? Because you've, again, always had that feel of kind of the travelling troubadour type thing. And again, there's points in the music industry. And there's a point where you can be doing decent-sized venues, not spending much and making a decent amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
There's then a point above that where you're having to spend out on a tour bus. And now me and Dan never got to that tour bus point. Yeah. We're always like, we'll be in the back of a van regardless. We'll do two nights at Coke. Like, we're doing these big venues, but a tour bus never seemed necessary. But then equally, I was discussing this this recently with some mates. It's a weird one where... If you get to the Coco level, it's a great venue. It's my favourite venue to play at. We did two nights there instead of a bigger venue on our last London tour because we love it. But then also, if you get to Brixton level, you've got to bring your own desk, bring your own PA. So it's this weird thing. There are these points.
I don't have to worry about it. It feels like you've kept
in between one of them points. If you jumped up a bit, you'd need a sound man, tour manager.
Yeah, I don't know that. I don't have any of that.
To just knock about on your own and do it.
Yeah, I've my own van, Bongo, which is incredible. And like the bigger tours we'll do as a duo, which would be me and Bob. And, we don't have a tour manager, sound man, anything, our rider's very small, stuff like that. Just like, we just keep it really, really simple. You know, just turn the lights on and leave them on, two DIs, two mics and we're done. Mate, and just like, no,
just I think simplicity is a...
And I've toured with bands and seen bands. And I think that, the kind of the grind of touring where it wears people down is, the carry in and the long sound checks.
Exactly.
And stuff like that. Like all we have, especially after touring the States, all we found is we have is time.
Yeah.
It's like, that's why I made this documentary about small towns, because I was like, we need something to do during the day. We should, and I'd find that, from asking on stage, we've got like a few hours to kill tomorrow. Does anybody want to take us on like a walk or to their place of work or anything like that? Do that with a camera. And we ended up in some incredible places.
I love that. And that's the kind of interaction, and it's the way, it's one of the ways that you've built such a warmth with a fan base, because you will be like, you'll crash at someone's house, or you'll go to see where they're go around their town with them the next day and things like that.
It makes it interesting it's inspiring as well, I always found with songwriting, you write a song, it puts you into a new and interesting situation, which in turn writes another song. So it's sort of like
it all feeds itself. It's weird because I've had countless gigs and I've adored pretty much all of them. It's one of the reasons I stopped when I did, because I was like, I'm kind of 10 years in, I've just done the biggest tour I've done with the biggest album I've done, and I've enjoyed it all. I've not got to the point where I'm hating it yet.
Right, okay.
So I'd rather
jump out.
At the peak. But the tour I've enjoyed the most, actually just having fun, is the spoken word tour I did with Kate Tempest and Polar Bear. And it's because it was exactly as you were saying there. we barely had to sound check. We'd literally just go, is there a mic?
Yeah, yeah, turn up mic, just before doors.
Then like, we're good. Yeah. All I was loading in was merch.
Yeah.
It's like, cool.
Don't even have to load that out. That's kind of easy. Well.
Yeah, exactly. And it was our mate Jim had a van, and sound man Jim was, he was the sound man of our local venues around here. In fact, some of the venues that my fake bands booked gigs at to build hype before we actually could do gigs,
right.
He was sound man at. And he was just this dude that we got to take on the road. And me, Tempest and Polar Bear in the back of a van with easy. No pressure. And when you, not in an arrogant way, but when you know your stuff, the gig's the easy part. It's the most fun part. Even when you're touring with a full band or whatever else, the hard part is, as you said, the loading in and loading out, the sound check, the gap between sound check and this and all that. The gig bit, it's kind of easy.
Well,
if they're already
the fun,
on side
that's
as well,
the, that's
if they're
the
your
fun
game.
Bit as
yeah.
well, isn't it? You know, that's that is ultimately what it's all about.
Yeah.
And yeah, the other bits just you kind of need to do. But yeah, I just have it so that them bits are everything I do is super simple.
Yeah.
Basically. I just keep it simple.
And how do you decide or define when you're going to do a tour versus, because again, you're someone who's always been, I think the reason I found you a lot on the spoken word scene is the spoken word scene when it was starting off was essentially all over mic nights. Like right. you weren't getting spoken word gigs. So,
right.
And you were, you were an open mic night type guy.
Yeah,
just,
I never
you'll go
really
anywhere
played
you can.
A huge amount of, I'd be like, I, it's always been people sort of presumed that. And yeah. And I did a few, but I'd generally sort of be on the poster rather than sort of like just turning up.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it'd
yeah.
just be just on, or the chalkboard mainly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
but it'd
yeah.
just be like, I just said yes to every gig. It was basically the thing. And it was, you know, when people, you know, when you're not asking for, you know, a couple of beers, then it's like, and people were putting on bands, just like, just chuck him on, you know, like it'll sort of get them going and rolling from that. So, yeah, I guess maybe that's it.
What do you feel makes a good unknown live act? Let me explain that. But I think it's why you've always worked great at festivals and you work great as a support is you've got something about you that if they're walking in and they've never heard of you, you win them over quite quickly. And that can be the tough thing of support slots or festival slots.
Right, yeah, yeah. Like, I think it's quite interesting.
It's
with
when
my,
it's your tour. If it's with, your tour, they're already your fans.
Yeah,
they know what's going
of course.
On, but,
well, I think my songs are quite instant, aren't they? It's not like, oh, I wonder what he's talking about. It's like, you know, it's like, this is a song about chicken farming. You know, it's called The Chicken Song. And it's all quite self-explanatory and you get it straight away. It's very sort of say what you see songwriting, basically. So it can, you know, and which I guess maybe makes it a tad sort of throwaway as well, but certainly it's certainly got that instant sort of like bang.
But
here
there's
it is.
An interest in this. In the, I mean, your statement of it maybe sometimes being a bit throwaway,
which
I don't necessarily think
is a bad thing.
No, I don't think it's a bad thing because, as you said, you're putting out an album every year.
Yeah, that's
therefore
it.
That's
when
part of the nature of it. You're
exactly,
doing it. You're increasing your list of options of songs. Every year, therefore, they have to be throwaway. There has to be certain songs that you go,
they're just
going to
get that one
anymore.
Play.
I can't do.
And talking about talking about you know current events as well, which will auto, you know, but you know, I had a song called 2016, which was written in June 2016. You know, that's got 6 months on it.
Yeah,
you know, and just from the nature of what I do, I'm not going to be like, here's a song about, you know,
I guess,
as soon as 2017 come, I've played it maybe once because somebody really wanted to hear it.
I guess that's another reason that I always kind of think of you alongside the spoken word scene is because of that. The spoken word scene was always a lot of bands will have the approach of we're writing our records secretly and then it's coming out in a year's time and things
right,
like that. You could do as what excited me at that point about the spoken word scene. Something could have happened that week,
and
you could be on stage in a couple of nights,
singing
about it,
you know,
and
I'll still do that now, you know, like that's
exciting. That gives it that urgency and that, and again, it does give it a shelf life potentially, but that's not the point of it. It's not about his,
but
I'm writing this
where
the live forever. It's like,
that's where the instantness comes from as well. If it's like, oh, right, he's talking
about
Cambridge Analytica, like, whoa, like, and so you know, it is. You know, talk about what's going on sort of there and then. And that's with this kind of, you know, I'm never normally one to look backwards, you know, certainly musically, but with this tour, it is a little bit like, you know, looking back to the first record and it's quite interesting to see not how much I've changed, almost how wrong I was on a few bits.
Mate.
You know, it's like there's most of the songs I'll stand by them and sort of still agree with them. I had one song called Fuck the Smoking Ban, yeah. And I was fully against the smoking yeah. ban. You know, I thought it was sort of like they was, you know, I was fighting for our culture at the time. Yeah. No longer a smoker. I can't stand it when people smoke inside. You know, like we're like, and I got songs about giving up smoking as well. It's not like I'm.
But
sort
that's
of like,
a good thing, man. I did a post recently, just saying on social media in the last, as we record this, in the last day, I think I put it up, just saying, look, everyone who's moaning, all the old school hip hop heads who are moaning about mumble rap, you're the same as the people that were moaning about your hip hop, saying. It's not even real music. They can't sing, and they're using samples. They're not even playing instruments.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it's like it's, punk and dubstep,
exactly.
It?
It's the like, same thing. Just you don't have to like it, but you don't have to.
You're not fucking supposed to. You're too old now.
And someone responded to that and said, "But isn't what you're arguing against? Isn't that what your song Fixed is about? It's saying you need to give respect to hip hop. I like it was in the old days." And I had to say to him, "I was like, yeah." And I was wrong. Thankfully, in 10 years, I've grown up, and my right. mind. You'd hope that in 10 years you'd yeah. develop your mind and develop your views and opinions.
You've got to be able
if
to
you're
your hand
married
up
to what you
wrong.
Decide in six, like 10 years ago, then that's a problem potentially.
Then, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, no, it's not exactly the same because what I'm saying in Fixed is that a great sound happened and a lot of people were just copying it, but still, it was still saying not as good as the old days of hip hop, which. He's dumb and ignorant, but that's right, the kid okay, I was at that yeah. point. I was like, old school's the way.
I think the biggest song error I had was, which again shows that a lot has changed. Well, it was like an environmental song on my first album called yeah. The Great Big Fucking Hole, and it was basically about the hole in the ozone layer
yeah.
Confused with climate change, right. Which at the time I was like, you know, You should try and use public transport. You should turn a light off when you leave the room, and you know, don't waste electricity because there's a hole in the ozone layer. And when I put it out, I got a few different people wrote to me, and I was like, your heart seems to be in the right place, but you're just misinformed. Like the hole in the ozone layer was a problem. It was linked to like CFC gas
yeah,
and polystyrene. It was like we actually changed our ways and fixed that. That's yeah. no longer a problem. The new problem is climate change, and that's why we shouldn't be wasting electricity, blah, 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 and energy. But, you know, there
the
you
two
go.
Two separate things.
Yeah, they're two separate things, which my answer was like, well, why didn't anybody say thank you for the fixing the hole in the ozone? Yeah. Clearly that poster I did in Science, you know, it was great.
I sorted that out, guys.
Yeah, but it's almost seriously like the, you know, it's bad management, isn't it? If someone does something good, you know, because people are told these environmental problems that are coming up, it's like doomsday, you know. No, but if it was like, look, there used to be a thing called the ozone layer, a hole in the ozone. That was a big problem. We sorted our shit out and fixed it. Now we've got another problem we need to fix.
Yeah.
It's like...
It should be taking the positive thing of, no, we can make a difference.
We've done it. Like, the hole is like, that's gone. You know, it's like, no one said that's gone. And it's like, so that, but that song, at the same time I had these people writing saying how wrong I was, somebody else wrote and said, really love your song, Great Big Fucking Hole. Working in primary school, I've edited the version so that it doesn't swear.
Yeah.
And here's my class singing and dancing to it.
Amazing.
For their school assembly. And I had to write to them and say, it's factually incorrect.
please adjust this.
Hole in the ozone. Do your posters about something else.
I love that. But again, I think people... One of our big problems in society is our stubbornness. Is that like, here's what I thought, therefore, fuck
can't change
else.
It.
It's like, no, you should be open to being convinced of ourselves.
Politically as well, people give me stick when I won, you know, for one election, I was like, Green Party, then it was like, vote Labour, and everyone's like, I thought you voted Green Party. It's like, I did then. You know, like, a lot's changed.
Now. Mate, it's a constant thing that people get so angry and ranty, and I had a guy who was mad at me recently because I had a Patrice Couleurs on, who started the Black Lives Matter movement, is one of the co-founders of Black okay. Lives Matter. And he was like, why have you had her on there, a terrorist organisation and all that? I was like, I'll discuss it with you if you listen to it.
Right.
And he was like, I've not listened to it, but this is like... Well, this... number one, I brought up the use of violence. I brought up the accusations of terrorism. So...
If you want to find out more about it,
it's been on there and discussed.
Surely talking about it is that what can you do if not that? If you don't want to...
Yeah, and he was just going on and on and on. And I said to him, One of the problems with debate on the right and the left is the inability to hear what the other person is saying. The wanting to have an opinion without doing any research. And he came back saying, well, you've assumed I'm on the right, but I've never said that, blah, blah. And I was like, you've not read the tweet even. You've assumed I said one of the problems with the
right,
conversation
right, okay.
on the right.
Yeah.
And he went quiet after that because like, that's how much assumption and confirmation bias you have. Because you thought I was attacking you. You've got, well, how do you know I'm on the right? I was like, go back and read the tweet, mate. I said the right and the left. It's a problem on both sides.
Is that part of the internet going to survive? Surely that needs to just be like that kind of the sort of comment section can just vanish.
It's dangerous and weird, isn't it? And my brother's a big believer on, he thinks we're wrong to constantly talk about how we've not figured out how we should use social media yet and things like that, because he thinks that it's overall damaging and we shouldn't. They're using it. It's bad. It's and again, a lot of the people who started your Facebooks and things like that have had big breakdowns and said, I've unleashed this kind of evil on the world, as we're seeing more and more right. with it influencing politics, what? With people just again.
It's crazy to think that they can swing an election with a few paid Facebook posts, though, isn't it? I mean, you know, everybody does it as well. It's easy to bitch about it, but you know, how would you sell your tours without it and whatnot?
Yeah.
And I think more fool the people that are falling for it as well. Like, I think people got their guard up a little bit more. Maybe, you know, before the sort of lid was blown off this, people did believe everything they read, and at least.
Which is crazy anyway. Yeah,
exactly. Man. You know, I have a hard time. I never really believed the news or TV before it was, the internet. And it, but if that's a lesson that's learned from it, then can't be a bad thing.
I'd Rutger Bregman on the podcast. And this is just us catching up now. We could end the podcast and just keep talking.
Right, I was going to say, is there
this
a time?
Is just like, we're still chatting.
Is there a time
no, there's no time limit. I had Rutger Bregman on, and he was saying, everyone goes on and on about fake news being the problem. His belief is one of the biggest problems in society is the news, because it skews our opinion on everything. Previously, we didn't know if something bad happened once in a part in somewhere on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
Now we see every small bad thing that happens and we assume the world has gone to shit. It's like, no, it's always been as shit as it looks. Do you know what I mean? If not worse, it's better than it was. It's improved. Because we're seeing it all now, we have this perception that it's all fucked and we can't do anything about it. And as you said, we've solved the hole in the ozone layer. Do you know what I mean? It goes back to that. That kind of, here's what we have done.
Yeah, definitely.
So it gives you hope. Otherwise, you can. It's so easy. And I've had this in the past. It's so easy to go, oh, we can't change the thing, though. Or, you can't.
Yeah,
the politicians are all the same, and this and that, or whatever else.
The world's falling apart, and it's in control, and it's being controlled by other people.
What can we do? It's like, well, you can do plenty. You can change your world instantly.
Exactly.
Like tomorrow, you can start doing things to change your world. Let's not worry so much about the world.
Yeah,
let's start smaller.
If there was an angle of my songs, that is it.
Yeah,
we definitely need to, look at each other more more than the screens.
So what's ahead? You've got the book coming out and you're going to tour that. You've got the huge 9th anniversary.
Seminal.
Your first album. After this, in fact, I'll tell people now, it might have come out before because I'm not sure when they're going out, but you're going over to do the Hardcore Listing podcast.
Yes.
Grays, which is a podcast I'm a fan of. I've been on numerous times, which is top fives, and your top five was...
I'm doing top five places to have a pint in England.
That's perfect, man. That's perfect. Stu was so happy because Stu, I'll tell you how Hardcore Listings started. I started doing the thing on the podcast just called The Drunk Cast.
We'd go and get drunk in
Stu's shed. And off the back of that, a company called Love Beer, who are great. I love beer. It's a weird one because they've sponsored and helped Hardcore Listing for a long while, but I've at points had different beer companies sponsoring the podcast.
Right.
So because Love Beer aren't an official sponsor, I feel confident. It's not even the money thing. It's like everyone who sponsors are independent anyway. So it's like, if they've paid...
Is there a beer sponsor?
But no, there's not at the moment. That's why I can say that Love Beer are fantastic. And they're awesome. So finally they can get their dues here as well as on Hardcore Listening. But they hit Stu up and said, do you want us to put some taps in? Because his bar was just his shed, essentially, that he had some seats in the fridge.
Beer on draft,
and they went and put in this thing that looks like stocks, and it's got draft, it's got kegs and everything. So you can have as soon as I saw your choice of the top five places to drink, I know Stu was like, number one, that's perfect. Yeah. Number two,
the shed's on the list.
I want to get in there.
Yeah.
By the end of the night, I want to be on the list. So
classic.
That's good fun. But yeah, so after that, is it still the same plan of more albums, more touring?
Yeah, keeping on. I mean, I'm off to the States next week.
Amazing.
Where I'm doing a bunch of headline shows, doing the Flogging Molly Salty Dog Cruise.
Wow.
Which is my fourth trip to the Bahamas.
Amazing.
So when
more
I said...
More and more people are doing these cruises,
mate,
man. I love
insane.
It.
It's...
If anyone is booking a one of these cruise things and they want a live podcast or just a podcaster, I don't even have to do anything live. I can document it along the way. Because again, they started to happen just as I was easing off of, or just as I stopped gigging, essentially.
Right,
but there's been rap ones that look amazing. There's a Chris Jericho, the wrestler, is doing the cruise,
right.
Which is, there's wrestling on there every day. There's bands. He's got a band called Fozzy. So there's bands. And
right.
I love the idea of it. I loved
it's so, because this is like a punk rock one. So it's like punk rock on a cruise ship is like a weird juxtaposition.
And it's a natural leap, because about a few years into my career, they started doing the festivals at holiday parks and stuff like that, and Pontins. And that was great because it was gold, because you've got the festival atmosphere, you've got everything there, you're doing it at a time of year when no one would be there, and you've got little cabins and it's a bit more comfortable. So
this is bloody comfortable.
But the leap onto a cruise is genius.
Yes. I mean, I got it for when I was saying, you know, one gig leads to another.
Yeah.
Like we did the Wembley show, and then that led to me doing the arena tour with Frank, main support on that tour with Flogging Molly. I became good friends with them over the course of the tour. And they just kind of said, look, if you can ever get to any Flogging Molly gigs, you can open.
Brilliant.
So I showed up at Detroit like a few months later. And I was how you doing? And I was like, they just loved the attitude. And, and then that night, they was like, we're planning this cruise, you should come. And I was like, well, of course I fucking should. You know, where do I sign?
I'm well up for that.
Did the first year, did it, and was just like so... I just had the best time, just rocked up in like a Hawaiian shirt and Bermuda shorts, like cheap plastic sunglasses, and you know, just went for it for the whole weekend and kind of became the sort of unofficial mascot for it. And and the guy that runs it and the band were just like, you should come next year. And then they actually, I was writing songs about the cruise on it. I was like, there was a water slide. I had this song about the water slide, and it was like, and they basically called me up and said, look, it was such a success. We're definitely going to do it next year. We're booking it now. If we send you the lineup, do you reckon you can get your kit back on and sing a song announcing the lineup? And I was like, am I on the lineup? They're like, Jay, you'll always be on the lineup. And and that was that. And
I
it's a trip to the, you know, it's open bar.
And like, how long are they?
It's a weekend, basically. It's weekend. Like you say, it's like there's three venues on the boat. It's 3,000 people, three venues on the boat. And you start off in Miami and you go to... Nassau in the Bahamas, and then a private island, and then back to Miami. And you sort of spend the days on the islands and then the evenings on the boat with the three venues. Like, the first year was like Go-Go Bordello, Frank Turner, Mariachi El Bronx.
Amazing.
This year it's The Offspring.
Wow, on a cruise.
Yeah.
I love it. I'm going to now, on record, copyright the idea of Podcast Away, the first podcast cruise. I'll get Buxton, I'll get Richard Herring, and we just go on a cruise, and it's just a podcast cruise.
Yeah.
Just chat. We can do, I've got my club night I do, so I can bring my DJ lads along, and we can do the podcast away.
Well, if you want an official mascot.
So. Perfect. You've got the history. You've got the sea legs.
I've already done it. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, where can people keep up to date with everything that you're doing and that's going on?
Google Beans on Toast. Took me a long time to get up above the food dish, but I'm there.
Yeah.
I made it.
I was going to say, that's a tough name to have when you...
It's harder in the images section of the internet.
Yeah,
but for the actual, the sort of the web search, you're fine. You'll get it there. Yeah, and the book comes out in May. But pre-orders now, before I go to the States, I'm signing and personalising any pre-orders. I've already sold enough pre-orders to cover my costs. So it's already a success as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. But you know, I'd like to get it into as many hands as possible.
One of the reasons I'm not the label on the head a little bit as well, is I realise I'm not built for the business side of it. Because everything that we've we've released, when we've got it in our hands of any artist and the artwork looks dope and the songs are dope, we've kind of gone, yes, it was a success.
Success. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, I've not looked at the record sales or any of that. That's hard. But it's like
we're happy with it.
Goal should be that. And the fact is, on a train, whilst at work, essentially touring, you've written a book and it's now published. It's going to turn up at your house.
Yeah, exactly. That's a massive success, something out of nothing. Yeah, and it feels like I'm really proud of it just because it's like the last thing I ever thought I would do. It's so far out of my sort of comfort zone of kind of songwriting. But at core, it's the same. It's creating something out of nothing. Yeah. And it really was that. You know, the actual, after the writing of it, it was just then finding people that knew what I was talking about to turn it into a book, basically. Yeah. And that was,
figuring out how to do that. And it's...
Exactly. That's done. Just dedication, isn't it?
Yeah. I love it. Well, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I'll catch you again soon.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Beans on Toast. I'm going to rerun through the dates now because, I said them at the start, I think, in the podcast. But so May 2nd, which should be tonight, right? What day is it? I don't know. Is Brighton Comedia. May 3rd is Bath Comedia. May 4th is Derby the Venue. May 5th is Kendall Brewery Arts Centre. May 6th, there's a matinee and an evening at the Voodoo Rooms in Edinburgh. May 8th, York the Crescent. May 9th, Sunderland Bonded Warehouse. May 10th, Belfast the Black Box. I did a great spoken word gig a good few years back there. I loved it there. May 11th, Liverpool Invisible Wind Factory. A matinee and evening one in Sheffield. That's at the Leadmill on May 12th. May 16th is Folkestone at the Quarter House. May 17th, Colchester Arts Centre. And May 18th and 20th, the Clapham Grand. That's a hell of a venue. And you can buy or go to the Sitting on the Chair tour and Standing on a Chair. You can get all, just basically head to beansontoastmusic.com. Beansontoastmusic.com. The book came out yesterday. So you can get that now, Drunk Folk Stories. And check all that out. I'll be back on Friday, guys, with a bonus podcast this week. And you do not want to miss it. Some of the stories told include Liam Howlett, Melly Mel, guy called Michael Jackson. Next week, after the Friday episode, of course. So we've got, as I said, Nick Hawkes on Friday. But then the week after that, on Wednesday, I've got Jamali Maddox, and a lot of people are hyped about that. I did a little post online in my Instagram story, and I got a lot of people excitedly responding. Chili Ray McCormack, who was in the Dark Summer photo shoot, was particularly hyped for it. That's going to be great. He's awesome. So that's May 9th. And then the next week, it should be MVP and Mark Goddard, and then that Ask Pip one. There's loads to come. But until then, this has been episode 202 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Beans on Toast. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.